Well, I was thrilled to be asked to be part of this by Tim, and in part, a large part, because I'm really like Steph, and I was really eager to work with this book and think with this book. At the same time, the skills which I brought to this book are not those that I think are most useful. So I enjoyed it in terms of critique, but I certainly learned an enormous amount, particularly about the numerous thinkers, many of whom I admire, and I think most of them, you know, the vast majority of the people that are in these pages and explore their thought, you know, are people that you've heard of. This is a kind of greatest hits of French post-war thought in a really compelling way, and I think it traces out this question of transparency with rigor over 22 chapters and a whole series of different sites and in a whole series of different discussions, these knots that Michael brought so much attention to. That said, again, I went in terms of my own thinking about how to approach this. The easiest way would have been to go with what I do pretty well, that is archival material, questions of context. And again, it seemed a little almost too easy, and I think it would have really not allowed us to think with the book in ways that I certainly hope people do with my own work, and I think that this book certainly merits. So I did come up with a series of possibilities that I haven't executed. I did engrams, for example. One of the key claims here is that this is a specifically French discussion. Engrams of the word transparency in languages like English, German, as well as French, you know, suggest that the use of the term over the post-war period maps onto them all almost exactly. I mean, it's like there's a three-instance difference or something, so that the late 70s in all three of these spaces, or at least all three of these languages, the term transparency emerges. So that I was like, well, what could one do with this? I'm not going to do anything with it. I did think about then as well the most obvious one. I mean, I'm glad the reference to Warhol was made here, of a claim again of this specific French post-war discussion and its resistance to transparency, that in attention to queer thought, notably around the comment from Warhol, but the intersections with Sontag, with understandings of camp, most particularly as a kind of more local knowledge or form of intellectual critique, would allow us to see other places, again, in this particular case, in the English and the Anglophone world, where critiques of transparency and rejections of transparency were happening in this same space, in many cases then not among the type of philosophers, the type of discussions then that are the focus of this book. That is, they might not have affected Rawls or Nagel, but they certainly have shaped a whole series of discussions. They continue to inspire a lot of the people, at least in this space, this country, and those in the Anglophone world who have worked with many of the theoretical models that Steph is helping us think with in very interesting ways. The title of my talk, again, suggests two of the things that I'm interested in, that I've worked on, and again, one of the ways to go with these, UNESCO on the one hand, Algeria on the other, would have been to delve far more deeply into the archival to help us think with it. And so I was particularly interested, for example, in Steph's really interesting discussions of the emergence of anthropology, by the emergence of anthropology around Levi-Strauss's definition, saving anthropology, cultural anthropology from the weight or the kind of shadow of physical anthropology, his challenge to thinking about ethnology, his intersections with ethnography, and it seemed to me that this was a space that I learned a lot from. I mean, Steph is very interested in these thinkers, notably Levi-Strauss, notably Leris, and others, and I think there's a lot to kind of grapple with. I mean, I think one of the ways where your reticence or your lack of attention to or focus on questions of context, and notably of archival questions, was in presenting us with a kind of stable world that where the Alice Conklin debates kind of crystallize around 1950 with the triumph of a Maussian, Rivettian inspired field that of ethnology, ethnography that becomes anthropology, that pushes to the side contesting visions. Again, we could talk about physical anthropology, far more explicit colonial anthropologies. Marcel Griol is the figure here in the book that plays, rightfully so, I think, you know, the key role of the people that are kind of marginalized and discussed. Now, a real different way to do this would be to really focus in on how confused and how totally new the scene of anthropology was in the post-war period. It was not simply that the students of Mauss and Rivet had triumphed. They had triumphed after being in conversation with Boas, after being abroad, after being funded by Americans, by the Rockefeller Foundation, within a whole new set of institutions that emerged. And perhaps confusingly enough, really at the center of these institutions, the Centre des Études Sociologiques, not anthropologique. So because part of what's going on here, of course, is that there is no easy distinction between sociology, ethnography, and anthropology in the post-war field, but in post-war France. These are being reinvented, breaking with, in most cases, the Durkheimian tradition, adopting and putting themselves into dialogue with primarily the Chicago school, but also Boas, of course. And therefore, all sorts of interesting intersections. One of the key examples here, and a figure that is absent from the book, is Pierre Bourdieu. Right? I mean, Pierre Bourdieu, who is both trained as an anthropologist and emerges as the kind of key sociologist. I think his thinking here would have allowed and kind of made necessary, you know, a more intense focus on these disciplinary crises, and would have, I think, opened up a whole different set of spaces around to think with the implication of most of the people who were living on had offices on the same hallway of the Centre Institut Sociologique with Lévi-Strauss, with Ballandier, with people that I'm talking about, people like Jacques Soustelle, talking about people like Germaine Tillon, who end up going to, who are, have chairs too, at the Ecole Pratique des Hautes Etudes, and yet go to Algeria to try and put into place a set of policies drawn from international discussions, transnational discussions that were taking place, a lot of them in Paris, after the connections that they'd made abroad, you know, back at UNESCO and here. Now, Bourdieu is also interesting because he, of course, made his transformation in Algeria. He made his transformation, and I want to kind of highlight this too, the way that you attend to ethnography, ethnology, anthropology. He made his first mark, of course, as an agrégé in, we know that there is no agrégation in ethnology, just as there is no agrégation in sociology. There is, however, an agrégation which he got in philosophy. He was seventh in the agrégation of 1954, the year that the Algerian War began. He famously, unlike most agrégés, left and became an enlisted soldier, and it was that way that he went to Algeria. One of the contexts that makes Algeria particularly important for French post-war thought is the fact that people like Nancy, like Braudel, like others, and like Bourdieu found themselves in Algeria for a set of reasons. But it's also worth remembering that after 1958, every agrégé had to go to Algeria as part of the integrationist programs that the French put in place. That is a whole key generation of the late 1950s, the people that would take up so many of the positions in French, not just French thought, but French intellectual institutions were there in Algeria. So again, Bourdieu, interesting in part because it allows us to think about how your attention to anthropology kind of misses some of the complexities of the reemergence of this as a discipline, but also some of the questions of which disciplines count. And Bourdieu, of course, struggled with this greatly. So I'm not going to go into my critique of Bourdieu's participation in Algeria, which some key philosophers, notably, of course, Rancière, Balibar, at the end of the 1970s, would really draw out the attention to how little he paid attention to the colonial situation, the Algerian War, when he was writing, for example, Sociologie d'Algérie, his first key Kissage publication. Or we're not going to talk about his implication, his dependence on people like Colonel Le Cornu, fellow Bernet, famous torturer, who allowed him to get access to many of the sites where he did his research. But instead, his tensions around leaving philosophy behind. What did that mean intellectually? How declining it is. And that will kind of lead us to another, or at least lead me, to another focus on these questions of institutions, notably of disciplines. And that is because there is another field that has an agrégation, and that is, of course, history. And the place of history as discipline in this book is very, very interesting. It's very interesting. In part, there are quite a small number, I would say, a rather small number of historians of contemporary France who are cited, who are brought into the book. This is not an effort to kind of map out the historiographical shape of historians, current historians, or more recent historians' discussions of what was happening in France at this time. So again, I think that this reticence or the kind of lack of the critique of the centrality of context is explanatory, helps us think with this. But it does raise a lot of questions, in part because you don't explore not just about citing historians, but the historians are not objects of investigation. That is, historians in this discussion do not appear as key figures in post-war French thought. What do historians think? How do they think? So I would be really interested in an exploration that would put historians alongside other thinkers, notably philosophers, notably anthropologists, who people the pages of your book. To help us think with that, or to help kind of map out what, one of the reasons why it seems to be self-evidently interesting, besides the fact that I'm a historian, and that I think it's interesting, is the figure of Pianola. And I wanted to kind of then go to a text and help us think with this, help us think through this, notably because Pianola has just recently republished Les Français d'Algérie. Now, Les Français d'Algérie is a book that I talked about and that saved me a previous time, that came out in March of 1961. Okay, so right after the referendum that had authorized self-determination, a few weeks before a new coup d'etat attempt, the four generals that would lead to and instigate the emergence of the OAS in the kind of final months of the war. This is a book that I really kind of borrowed heavily from or leaned heavily on in my first book in a chapter, the kind of only chapter I think in that book that was very little archive, that has relatively a paucity of archives, and it turns instead to questions of gender and sexuality. And Les Français d'Algérie for me was emblematic, that is, and it served so usefully by a clear demonstration of statements that these people in Algeria are different from the French. And this is something that I was intrigued by, how little explanation there was, how few people you saw in Sartre, you saw in Aron, you didn't see it in De Gaulle, you didn't see it in any number. People refused to state clearly, these Algerians are not French on the French side. And of course, we've all heard of Republican Universalism, and this is pretty easily explainable in those terms. It's incredibly difficult to say that these people who are citizens are not French, and these people were at that point all citizens. So Nora proposed a very straightforward, very clear affirmation that people from Algeria were not French. They were wholly different. They were backwards. They were dominated by men. You never saw women in the streets. These people, of course, were the Pieds-Noirs, les Français d'Algérie. These were the people who were nothing like metropolitan French people. These were the people who were driven by irrationality, by violence, by pulsions that could not be fit into the logos, the Cartesian spirit that Nora himself knew were central to what it meant to be French. Nora, of course, who had been sent, like all these other agrégés, to teach in high schools in Algeria, in this case in Oran. So I found this really interesting at the time, and I think particularly in its gendered implications, its definitions of its implications of sexuality, its description of manliness, and a kind of aberrant, overflowing masculinity that he attributes and for him define the Algerians, the Français d'Algérie. But more recently, the new edition also has some additional information. It has a whole critical apparatus. An introduction by the man himself, by Pianola, now a member of the Académie Française, as well as some additional materials, responses to the book at the time. Now, in the introduction, he once again makes the type of clear statements that marked the text itself when it came out. Une situation coloniale de ce type ne pouvait se convertir pacifiquement en indépendance nationale. La dénonciation du libéralisme, that is his own, of the liberals of Algeria, était dans la droite ligne de cette logique. So he has a series of logics. This is self-evident. I therefore expressed it. At the end of the book, the first additional annex that's now included is what he describes as a 50-page letter from a certain Jacques Derrida. Jacques Derrida, he had been at Cannes with him, therefore they'd prepared for the Grand Secret together. They had taken different pathways. They had taken and passed different agrégations. And Derrida then at this point was not in Algeria. But of course, as everyone knows, I think, was born in Algeria. So the book comes out in March of 1961. The 20 and 21st of April is the explosion of violence, this attempted coup d'etat by the four generals that de Gaulle and others put down. The letter is written on the 27th of April, 1961. again, as I said, Noah describes it as a 50-page letter. In the book itself, it's 27 pages of text, and it begins with "Mon cher Noah." So I wanted to go to a couple different passages here. It says, "N'est-il pas difficile de faire endosser par quelque chose comme les Français d'Algérie, malgré la culpabilité constante et massive qu'ils ne font ni méconnaître ni diluer sous prétexte de la faire partager, toute la politique de la France en Algérie depuis 130 ans. So he's saying, quite clearly, you, and this is what interested me in the book when I first read it, this effort to say that everything that has gone wrong in Algeria is the responsibility of the colonizer. And the colonizer are the pieds noirs. Again, if we think back to Fanon's critique, they are going to try to blame the colonizers, but it's the colonial society, that is Europe itself, in this case France, that needs recognition. So an effort to say this is a little more complicated than what you're saying. And it continues. Evolution, encore. Peut-on dire à la fois que l'Algérie est évêque à certains égards l'Afrique du Sud, le seul de tous les pays coloniaux du 19e siècle où s'est développée une population qui n'est plus directement liée à l'appareil colonial? Vérité qu'on ne souligne jamais assez en effet, et que, deux, l'industrie ne leur parle pas, et que la terre seule les rassure, de France et d'Algérie. Je crois que c'est de plus en plus faux. Again, an effort to say that these certainties that he's doing that are psychological in tone, but also claim to be economistic, are inaccurate, that things are more complicated. Ce n'est pas un détail, c'est dans la mesure dans tout ton livre, fait communiquer et en même schéma psychanalytique, la mort de la terre et la peur des hommes. So a psychoanalytic frame that says they're afraid of the earth, they're therefore afraid of other people. And these other people then are not just primarily, of course, Algerians themselves, but other French people too. A complete distrust of everything here. La terre seule, he's citing de Nora. La terre seule rassure, parce que les hommes font peur. Ce qui t'empêche pas de dire ailleurs, je cite, la ville, la rue, la foule, voilà sa défense le plus efficace. Institution. Et puis l'intervention de la psychanalyse pour expliquer les difficultés de la réforme agraire, pour une fois que la vérité est simple et massif et sommaire. So in these moments when there's another clear explanation, you've chosen a really complicated one that gets back to a simple schematic explanation that puts all the blame on these people and their faults. On ne peut considérer que les FTA, Français d'Algérie, qui ont approuvé la rébellion, ou tous ceux qui ne se rangent entre le libéralisme Algérie française et l'FLM, la gamme étant abondante et mouvante, comme de simples aberrations, imprévisibles à partir d'un type normal. Il faut les expliquer aussi par autre chose que la fantaisie ou le romanticisme, ou même la lucidité courageuse, par d'autres ressources psychologiques et sociologiques du milieu. Again and again, then, an effort to point out how much more complex the world is, how much more confusing it seems to be. I just want to do one more quote here. De même encore à propos de Germaine Tillon. So one of the things that marked the book's publication was his, Pierre Nora's, direct attacks on two figures that had remained heroes for many, Albert Camus on the one side and Germaine Tillon on the other. Camus' kind of star had faded in many ways because of his refusal to engage in discussion about the Algerian War after he had received the Nobel Prize for Literature and been criticized publicly, his famous "Je préfère ma mère à la justice," and he stopped talking about it. And then, of course, he died. So his star had faded among many people on the left, but still as a signal for something that mattered to many people in broader discussions. Germaine Tillon, on the other hand, a hero. Someone who had become a hero and known as a hero for being in Ravensbrück, for her role in the resistance, for her leading place in the study of ethnology, her key work in ethnography, and a participant then in these post-war discussions alongside people like Barandier and Lévi-Strauss, who she'd left behind to go rejoin Jacques Soustelle, fellow anthropologist, fellow ethnologist in Algeria, and do work, but had worked with and spoken to members of the FLN, been in communication, sought to save people from torture, sought to negotiate ends to FLN terror. His direct attack on her also was something that sparked much shock, and the effort here was to attack any way to think with liberalism as something that could be complicated, something that would be interesting. He says, Et quand je, de même encore, à propos de Germaine Tillon, je suis peiné de t'entendre dire que les voix intérieures qui nous soufflent que c'est plus compliqué que cela sont pour toi celles de toutes les démissions. So anything that suggests it's more complicated than that, the historian, in this case Pierre Nora, drops to the side. And Derrida, constantly insisting how much he appreciates the book, how much he recognizes much of the psychological portrait that is being drawn in its ventre, insists that its explanatory value is so little, that any attempt to explain what's happening has been abandoned, any attempt to explain why people have made certain choices or what possibilities could be have been abandoned. That is this complete back and forth between an insistence that it's all self-evident, it can all be seen, and Derrida's constant effort to think with not just his own implication, his own very personal implication in Algeria, but an implication, how do you think? And how do you think? Now, for me, and I'm going to end here, this resonates with a little episode that happens and that I treat in the conclusion of my book. In the conclusion of my book that recently came out, it ends with an attention to the kind of explosive effects in French discussions of the Iranian Revolution. The book is France, Sex, and Arab Men. In Iran, there aren't Arab men, at least for the most part. But I am really interested in the reemergence of a different figure, the more classic figure of so-called sexual orientalism, that is the veiled Muslim woman. And 1979, early 1979, sees this explode into public discussions, notably in France. Okay? Notably on the 8th of March, 1979, International Women's Day, when massive protests in Tehran are echoed by massive protests in France. And in France, then, this early discussion of what is happening with the Iranian Revolution focused on two figures, the veiled woman being forced backwards into the veil out of freedom, and homosexual men who are being executed. And it's an interesting moment in Libération, for example, efforts to say, well, they're not being executed because they're homosexuals. They're being executed because they're pedophiles. There's been a giant debate in France about pedophilia in the last year and a half, since 1977, and that will keep going for several years afterwards, or because they are proxénètes, that they're pimps. And again, this other discussion of pimping, of prostitution, had also been something that had been caused much discussion, notably on the left, but more broadly in the 1970s. So a whole series of discussions that were quite intense. And one of the things I try to trace out in the book is these what proved untenable efforts on the so-called far left, but most particularly among gay liberationists and feminists, to look to the Arab man, the revolutionary Arab man, as a model for how to change things in France. Too complicated to hold. Provide, I mean, it's based on a stereotype, of course. The revolutionary Arab man is as much a stereotype, of course, as the idea of the rapist Algerian man or the Arab man who's violent and a thug who's leading the Arab invasion proposed by the far right. But in this case, for the far left, particularly feminist, particularly liberationist, it proves too difficult to happen. So in early April 1979, an article by another person, a philosopher who I think would have been interesting to deal with and would brought some of these kind of queer discussions and their own implications, notably his attention to American discussions by Warhol and others, the philosopher Guillaume Kingem wrote an article in the newspaper Libération. And he reported to his readers that Michel Foucault had, quote, been attacked in his home, been beaten. And it was a beating that Hockingham blamed on the context. In the heat of an intense debate among intellectuals and in the press about Iran, Hockingham deduced, something has gone decidedly wrong. Now, it does not seem to be the case that Foucault was beaten up, at least not in April 1979 or in these conditions. I found no evidence of this. Still, this report of a physical attack because of Foucault's analyses of the Iranian Revolution. And again, remember here, Foucault had published these in Corriere del Sud. They'd gotten a lot of attention in the lead-up to what becomes the victory of the Iranian Revolution, so at the end of 1978, where he'd looked to this as a possible inspiration to think differently about the world. This beating, then, is a metaphorical metaphor for the end of the history that I'm interested in, the end of an attempt to think in really complicated and dense ways without any clarity at all. Hockingham referred up to a particularly cutting attack against Foucault and others who had shown sympathy for the Iranian Revolution in the left-wing newspaper Le Matin de Paris, which had the outrage title, What Could Philosophers Be Thinking? Question mark. He, Hockenheim, another philosopher, his article here grouped this, the broader attacks on Foucault's writings on Iran under the title, quote, "Death to the Traitor." This is how he was qualifying the types of attacks that Foucault was subjected to. For Hockenheim, this radical gay philosopher, what drove the critics was, quote, "something that doesn't necessarily have a direct connection to the content of Foucault's claims about Iran, which is more in the domain of a generalized, even hysterical, guilt trip, which makes it impossible to exchange information to discuss," end quote. References to history in Hockenheim's interpretation of the attacks on Foucault could no longer be a means to open new possibilities to think. Quote, "any reflection on this subject, the Iranian Revolution," end quote, instead required, quote, "immediate judgment on charges of treason and of counter-treason brought before the docket of history with a grand H." So you can see here then this effort, this insistence that this Foucaultian effort to take seriously different ways of being in the world, of different epistemes, of different ways of thinking, of different ways of identifying, this was being at least identified by Hockenheim and others as no longer worth our time. It's just too complicated. Things need to be too clear. And the same responses took place to these articles in Liberation that thought to caution, well, it's not really homosexuals that are being, they said, we know what this is, let us name names. Homosexuals are being executed, they're being executed because they're homosexuals. All these wordplay, that's not so interesting. So I think this also lines up nicely, this attempt to eliminate certain types of complication from telling histories, histories in the present, the immediate present here, not history of the present, with the timeline that Steph helps us map out of the new attention to transparency in the 1970s that ruges and explodes. And the engrams show this quite clearly in the 1980s. So again, I think there's so much to do here with the inspiration, here with the thinkers. I think there's so many more thinkers to bring in that I think would trouble, particularly, as I said, the kind of boundary around France that you've set up, but also so many more thinkers within France and without France. I mean, part of the, again, that would have been useful to explore, I think, with ethnographers in particular, is how deeply embedded they were, and we heard about some of this yesterday, in transnational networks as well as international organizations, where a lot of this material was coming from, ways of thinking were coming from elsewhere and being discussed elsewhere and certainly being inspired by other situations. But I want to thank you again for this opportunity to talk about what interests me, to talk about the Lovejoy Professorship, which has also been exciting, and to be reminded that one of the things that we share, although this is background, is that I was trained in a department that was where Lovejoy was. I mean, I arrived and I teach in a department with Pocock, the Cambridge School, Lovejoy, etc., history, and a very different tradition at the same university. It was until it was attacked and forced to change its name, the Humanities Center. But again, another striking institutional site where forms of thinking that are outside the norm, I think, in American discussions writ large, in history, remain nurtured. So I, for one, welcome the kind of multiplicity of different possibilities of looking at the past. And I think I wanted to take this opportunity not to kind of, again, descend, it's not just to context or to the archives and say this is the only way to do this, but to hopefully spark more dialogue between different approaches to thinking about past that matters a lot to me. Thanks a lot.